It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The Washington Post, it has a new personal health desk with a team of physicians, mental health professionals, and journalists to answer questions and share the latest research on living a healthy and fulfilled life. So we've snagged the desk editor for a spell. Join in on your challenges this season to being your best you, or research you've wondered about on how to live a healthy and fulfilling life, the secrets that you scoff at or take to heart. 800-642-1234. Tara Parker Pope is well-being editor of the Washington Post. She previously was the founding editor of Well, the New York Times' consumer health site, and she was part of the Times' team that won the Pulitzer Prize for its coverage of the pandemic. Tara, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, you've been reporting on health and well-being for years and years. I've read article after article. How do you define well-being? What does it mean to you?
Well, I think that's one of the big questions we've been asking ourselves at the Post, because I think health and well-being has changed over the years. And I think that our readers are recalibrating what it means to live well. I think maybe some of the things that we thought were important 3 years ago, we might have changed our minds during the past 3 years. I think we've learned a lot about the value of good health and what good health really involves. And I think that part of the reason why we chose the name well-being is that there's so much that goes into a good life, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we want to be healthy so that we can live our best life. And I think that living well is not just about, you know, exercise and eating well. Those are two really important things, but it's also about your mental well-being. It's about your family health. And it's about the things that make you happy every day, like your pets and your relationships and your hobbies. And so I think we really want to take a holistic approach to well-being, and we want to be inclusive. I think a lot of personal health reporting in the early years of sort of this beat has sort of been directed at like perfect people who are like super fit and run marathons. And I think we really want to be inclusive, and we want to celebrate all levels of ambition and ability, and recognize that many people live with chronic illness and have disability. And we want our stories to include everybody. And we want everybody to feel like that we're talking to them, that we're not talking to, you know, some ideal of what health should be.
Right. Someone who can just go out there, lace up the shoes and run a 10K or, you know, a marathon or something. You know, and I think our perception of health and wellness is being valued differently as the pandemic has jolted us in so many ways in these years. I wonder if the value of health and wellness journalism, because it sometimes it got lumped into like a lifestyle category, not taken as seriously. Do we take it more seriously?
Well, I take it more seriously. I mean, one of my pet peeves is that people think that wellness, I put quotes around that, journalism is sort of health light, you know, L-I-T-E. And it's not, you know, well-being desk, it's very science-based. And I think if we've learned anything during the pandemic, it's the value of science and science-based and fact-based reporting. So I really wanted to bring that sensibility to this desk. And I wanted people to know that when they were reading a story from us, that they could trust it, that it was vetted by experts, that, you know, we are bringing in doctors and mental health professionals and really experienced journalists who, you know, every story, you know, it's just not enough to kind of quote some lifestyle influencer to say this is good for you. You know, I want the science behind it. If we're gonna talk about an issue, I don't want it to just be, you know, something that people are sort of speculating about. I want there to be science behind it, because I think it's really important to build that trust with our readers and for them to know that, you know, I think we talk about how we've changed our feelings about health. You know, we used to talk so much about weight loss and diet. And you know, my feeling is like, if you're still here, if you got through this pandemic and millions of people did not, like, I am so grateful to my body. Like, I am overweight. I'm not in perfect health, you know, like many of my readers, but I'm not going to beat myself up every day because I'm not, you know, perfect. I'm just really glad to be here, and I appreciate what health is about. And I think we need to, you know, keep repeating that message to people. I think there's a lot of There's a lot of shame that goes on in wellness reporting, and I think we have to stop that. That's really not what health is all about.
Tara Parker Pope with us, well-being editor of the Washington Post, as we explore what is well-being and some of the work that she's been doing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tara, I think what's really interesting is that your wellness work is also prioritizing helping us make sense of the health information that we encounter on social media and tackling some misinformation. What should we be mindful of?
Oh, that's so interesting. You know, we've done a few stories on this because so many people get their health information off of social media. And it's interesting. We just had a story published today. I hired a neuroscientist to write about the neuroscience of, you know, everyday life. And he wrote a story today about why our brains believe lies. And, you know, we evolved to believe that the information we were collecting in the world around us was accurate. You know, if you're seeing, you know, if you just kind of think about our ancestors, you know, they had to kind of pay attention to the details to know if they were safe, if there was a wild animal nearby, you know. But now in this world of sort of social media and this barrage of information that we are, you know, that's hitting us every day, our brains don't know what to make of it. Our default is to believe the things we hear. And what's really fascinating is that I learned from this story that Richard wrote about why our brains believe lies is that once a piece of information lands in our brain, our memories don't delete it, even if we later learn that it wasn't true. And we really do struggle. So I think there's a mindfulness required when we're reading something. We really have to check ourselves and say, do I know this to be true? Is the evidence here in the story? And I think that we should really hold everything we read accountable, and we should really look for expertise. You know, when I'm editing a story and I see somebody quoted, I say, you know, what is their experience? What do they bring to this? I remember editing a story the other day saying, what is this person? What are their credentials? Why are they in this story? You know, as an editor, I challenge it with my reporters. And I think as readers, we need to challenge our sources of information and really make sure that it's credible and that the people speaking, you know what they're talking about.
But that diligence of seeking truth, that takes time, that takes effort and patience, and people are really strapped for time. So how do you strike that balance, wanting to believe, our brains believing, and yet we know, you know, what that hygiene is about in terms of trying to make sure what we're reading is accurate?
Well, one, I think I always have thought readers are very smart, and I believe that. But I think that it's important that we think about our sources of information. I always say, where did you read that? Look, we know what credible sources of information are. And I think that one of my, you know, yes, it takes time, but really it should take my time and my reporter's time. And so we're spending the time vetting the information so that when you read a story in the Washington Post, you know we've done the homework for you and you don't have to spend that time. So I think it's important, really the time you should spend as a reader is asking yourself, is this a reliable source, a consistently reliable source of information? You know, if you see something flash on Twitter, you know, go to your reliable source, you know, ask what that is. Come to the Washington Post and see if we wrote about it. This happened to me the other day. I saw something. I was in a group of people and they showed me some story that flashed. And I said, I will believe it if I see it in the Post. And I went and I searched, and there actually was a story about that issue in the Post, but it was a little bit of a different, you know, more thoughtful take on it. So I think we all have, that is where I would ask the reader to take a moment, think about the source of your information. And if you, you know, if it's just somebody randomly on Twitter, click and find the source. You know, most stories have links in them and you can click on it. And if that fact came from the Journal of the American Medical Association or the New England Journal, then, you know, you can feel better about it. I actually don't think it takes that much time. It takes mindfulness, right? It takes taking a beat and saying, what am I reading? Is this reliable? That's really all the time it takes.
Talking with Tara Parker Pope, editor of the Washington Post well-being section, on our health journey, tips that we can put to use in this season. Join in on how you achieve a state of well-being each day or what that means to you. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent as we check in on the latest news and advice on how to live well every day with longtime health journalist Tara Parker-Pope as our guide. Tara recently launched the Well-Being Desk at the Washington Post. That's well plus sign being. Join in on food, on fitness, mental health, guidance you seek in uncertain times, or if you feel on edge heading into the holiday season, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. And Washington Post well-being editor Tara stays with us. You know, let's talk about jobs. A lot of people quitting their jobs during the pandemic in the, you know, so-called Great Resignation. You were one of those people leaving the New York Times after 15 years. How should people incorporate work into their well-being?
Well, we spend so much time at work. I mean, I think there's so many, we could talk forever about it. But, you know, I think that one of the, you know, work has changed a lot in the past couple of years because so many people work at home and they realized they could do their jobs differently. And that gave people a lot of flexibility, but it also meant that work was really encroaching on our home life. I am exhibit A right there. You know, I've worked at home most of my journalism career. I was unusual in that. So when the pandemic hit, it's not a big deal at all for me to work at home. But it can really become a 24/7 thing. And I think that we need to think about the role of work in our lives. Work is fulfilling. It's, you know, it should be fun and interesting and expansive. Maybe it's not for everybody. I know many people work because they need to work and they need the paycheck, and not everybody has the option of a sort of fun, fulfilling job. And I recognize that. And I think, you know, there's different ways, you know, to live life. And for some people, you know, having a job that pays the bills and takes care of their family allows them to have a, you know, a fulfilled life outside of work. But I think that when we're thinking about changing jobs, this is my process. I actually was looking at some of the science on this about how you make decisions. And I think there are questions you can ask yourself if you're really thinking about making a change. You know, how well are your bosses communicating to you? Or do you know what's expected of you at work? You know, do you have the tools and the, you know, the materials you need to do a good job? Do people praise your work? Do they appreciate you? Do you feel like you have agency? Do your opinions count? I think one of the most fascinating things about the study of work and, you know, work relationships is asking the simple question, do I have a good friend at work? And studies show that's a really meaningful factor in our happiness at work, you know, our work relationships and our work friendships. And I actually did have some great friends at the Times, but I also had many people who were leaving and changing and moving on as, you know, as priorities shifted there. And losing those friendships, it just, work wasn't, you know, losing those people around me, it wasn't as much fun. I just thought, you know, a lot of things went into my decision. The main reason I left the Times was because I had this incredible opportunity at the Post, and I really believe in the leadership here. And what I really loved is the emphasis on holding power to account and empowering readers. I mean, that's just the mantra here. And I really liked bringing that sensibility to personal health journalism, because as you noted at the top of the show, that, you know, so much of health journalism is kind of lifestyle. I think it's much more important than that. And my reason was because this was a mission that I believed in. And I think thinking about mission and purpose at work is really important to everybody. You know, whatever your role is, you know, are you making a contribution to the well-being of your coworkers, to your community? We all do that. Even, you know, I remember during the pandemic talking to like a 17-year-old who was a delivery person and, you know, really living off tips. And he's like, I do this because I'm young and healthy and I know I can really help people during the pandemic. And that this way, you know, maybe people who are vulnerable don't have to go out to the store and put themselves at risk. So he found real value and purpose in his job. And I think that that's how we need to think. You don't have to have a prestigious job. It's, do you know that your role is making a difference in people's lives? And I think that's where we should be thinking about when we're making decisions about work.
What is your take then on quiet quitting? You know, maybe at the intersection of well-being, that slump in ambition and the professional drive that is being so much talked about right now.
Yeah, you know, I'm sorry to say I'm a little skeptical that the quiet quitting is more than just like a cool way to talk about work. I'm skeptical. I think that quiet quitting is really just about reprioritizing your life and realizing that work doesn't have to define your life. And that is a healthy thing for you as an individual. And frankly, that is a healthy thing for your workplace. I tell my reporters all the time not to burn out, not, you know, I don't want them getting RSI injuries, you know, repetitive stress injuries in their hands. And I want them to have happy, fulfilled lives outside of work. And I want them to sleep and not stay up all night working, because I know they're going to be more productive, happier, better writers if they're taking care of themselves. So yeah, you know, quiet quitting is a fun term. I think there's just a reassessment of priorities. And we were working at kind of an intense pace during the pandemic. We were all at home and we were letting work bleed into our lives. I really think quiet quitting is just about resetting our priorities and realizing that to be a quality worker, we also need to have, you know, time away from work. So yeah, that quiet quitting thing, that's going to fade. We're going to stop talking about that, I hope, very soon.
Tara Parker Pope, well-being editor of The Washington Post. You can join in the conversation about well-being, what it means to you, what challenges that you've encountered, especially now heading into the change of seasons, the holidays ahead. 800-642-1234. Tara, you have a piece that explores how people can prepare for a third holiday season in the pandemic. What should people keep in mind for the holidays?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what is important to remember is that sometimes the news about the virus is going to change, but how we cope with COVID is very consistent. You know, get vaccinated, get your booster. I just got my bivalent booster yesterday. I have a very sore arm, but other than that, I'm doing okay. You know, I'm really conscientious about when I'm in a crowd, about still putting on a mask. I get tested every week at the office, and I test before I go to people's homes. If there's a vulnerable person there, or if maybe I've been traveling and I'm a little concerned about my exposure. But you know, my life is super normal. I'm not in a mask all the time. I'm not hiding out. I'm going out with friends and I'm seeing people. But I think that as we notice the virus, you know, paying attention to your community, and if there's like a lot of, you know, spread, I think we need to just be a little more mindful about where we spend our time. I'm still not going into crowded bars, but you know what? I didn't do that anyway. But young people, my daughter, she still goes out and hangs out with her friends. And she's just careful when she's, you know, if she's going to be around me, she's going to test and just be a little more careful, because she knows that her socializing is a little different than mine. But I think really it's going to be a pretty normal holiday season, or it can be. I think you just have to have plan B. You know, get your flu shot, get your vaccination, use mask when you travel. Think about outdoor entertaining. Like, it was super fun, frankly, eating outside with heaters and drinking hot cocoa around a fire pit. That was kind of fun when we did that, when things were a little less, you know, clear. But I think that the main thing is when you're planning for holiday travel, because people are still getting COVID and because we want to be smart, I think you kind of always have to have that plan B. You know, I know people that have gone to Europe and gotten sick and didn't have a plan B for how they were going to like stay before they could fly home. So just always think about plan B. But otherwise, I mean, the fall is a great time of year to be with your friends. And I'm going to, you know, spend time with my family in Texas for Thanksgiving. And I'm probably going to go see my daughter in Spain at Christmas. That's my plans. So I'm going to
stick with those. Yeah.
I'm going to power through.
What would be your advice for dealing with political discussions, you know, as we have such a polarized election Tuesday? I mean, especially in family gatherings.
Oh my goodness. This is my life. I have a very mixed family situation in terms of political beliefs. And, you know, when you talk to the experts, the main thing they tell you, they literally say, do not talk about politics at the Thanksgiving table. Just don't. It'll ruin the meal and it will be useless and everyone will just get upset. And, you know, it doesn't work. Like, especially if you have like one family member who drives you crazy, like, it turns into an attack on that person and they just feel bad and they just kind of dig in. Mm-hmm. You know, if you really want to talk to someone, start by listening to them and maybe plan and go away for coffee. There's actually science to show this, you know, go sit and have coffee and ask them, well, where did you hear that? Why do you believe that? Like, listen. And listening is the best way to connect with someone, not shouting at them and telling them your beliefs. So, you know, I think just be smart about it. Just enjoy the meal and your family and the time together. And I think we all need to practice a little acceptance that sometimes we don't agree with the people we love. That's okay.
veteran health journalist, Washington Post well-being editor Tara Parker Pope, helping us rethink what it means to live a healthy life, reflecting what we've learned in these recent pandemic years. Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Tara Parker Pope. She's been a health and columnist, science writer for over 20 years, recently launching the well-being desk at The Washington Post, focusing on advice that celebrates all levels of ambition and ability, as she puts it, helping us achieve a state of well-being every day. Join in what wellness advice that you've taken to heart, that you put to use and why, or health advice you question, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. And The Washington Post well-being editor Tara Parker Pope stays with us. Tara, I want to look at barriers to getting mental health care, because your team has compiled tips to get mental health help when there is this therapist shortage. We've heard about these long waiting lists to get access to mental health care to treat, you know, depression and anxiety. What should we be aware of?
Yeah, I mean, this is real, and it's, I don't know when it's going to get better. It's, there's just a big problem with long waiting lists. You know, we reported that a major hospital, Mass General, had like 880 patients on its waiting list, and they were telling providers, you got to stop sending us referrals for all but just the most urgent cases, because we can't keep up with this demand. That was for a psychiatry wait list. But we actually talked to about 300 therapists and said, how bad is it out there? And they're all just saying, we're getting slammed. You know, we're not even keeping wait lists because it's just so impossible because the demand is so great. So what we wanted to hear is like, well, what do you do? Like, if you can't find a therapist and you need help, what do you do? Mm-hmm. And it's tough. But what's interesting is a lot of these therapists are doing really unconventional things. And they're telling, you know, soccer coaches and you know, a clergy, and, you know, reach out to people, you know, in your orbit, who maybe aren't a therapist, but who can talk to you and who can give you counsel and who can support you. There's also, you know, just persistence counts here, because you can often find, if you try, if you're willing to just kind of keep trying, you can sometimes find a newer therapist that maybe doesn't have the long waiting list yet. I actually was helping a family member find therapy, and I really just made so many calls, but I did finally find someone who was a social worker who had availability, and that was, you know, a great opportunity. So I think if you can be flexible, if you can schedule your therapy Monday through, you know, Friday during the workday, if you can maybe take a break at work, if you can do telehealth, you're more likely to get an appointment than if you're trying to get, you know, the better time or evening or late in the week. I hate to say it, but considering an out-of-network provider is one way, but it costs more. And really only people of means can do that. One really interesting suggestion is to find a therapist in training. Some of these therapists are hiring interns and bringing in students who are training to be therapists. Some colleges and schools, I actually know people who do this with dentistry. They go to like schools where
school. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a way to save money on dentistry. And this is an idea for finding a therapist in training who can help you. So I thought that was actually a really helpful idea. The other thing I would just say really quickly is that think about support groups and therapy groups, because group therapy can be much easier and faster to get into it, or even going to a support group, you know, if the issue is addiction. If you think about a group format, you can actually usually get into those. So ask a therapy practice if they have support groups or group therapy, and that is a faster way to get access to therapy right now.
What are your thoughts on all of these apps popping up to find a therapist and to, you know, go into a therapy session? You know, I'm going to name names, BetterHelp and Talkspace, and we're kind of getting inundated by advertising of these types of apps. What do you make of that?
I think that technology is great and it creates new opportunities. And I think that, look, I have used telehealth apps to find, you know, if I couldn't get an appointment with my doctor and I needed a prescription refilled or something like that, I've used it myself. Mm-hmm. I think that if it works for you and if you feel comfortable with it, again, I think you have to be careful if somebody has a, you know, a significant medical problem or maybe they seem suicidal. I think you have to use kind of emergency services in those situations, or maybe use the 988 helpline. But I think if you're just looking for ways to cope, and it, I don't want to say just, I mean, these are very important issues. So I think that if BetterHelp or Talkspace or if any of the apps appeal to you, try it. Try it once and see how it works for you. I think it can be a really great option at a time where just in-person therapy is just not accessible for many people.
I've read about self-care, that as you're waiting perhaps weeks for a session, that one way is, you know, that could potentially reduce some symptoms of stress and depression and anxiety is self-care. Do you have some ideas for self-care or how we should think about it and approach it?
You know, I think that the mistake we often make when we're talking about health and wellness and personal health is that we feel like there has to be sort of suffering and struggle if we're actually going to accomplish anything. And I think practicing self-compassion is actually one of the nicest things we can do for ourselves. I think we need to imagine if you were talking to a friend about whatever this issue is, we talk to our friends with such compassion and we give them grace. And yet when we think about our own challenges in life, we're really hard on ourselves. You know, we have this inner critic telling us that, you know, we're failing. And I think that we would make a big dent in people's sort of health and well-being if we all practice a little self-compassion and just gave ourselves a break. I also think that learning to practice acceptance, you know, we let a lot of things bother us, like traffic and you know, just the things that go wrong in life. And I think that we've learned some, we've gotten some perspective, I think, from the pandemic. And I think that, you know, falling back and saying, you know, this is a problem and this is, you know, life is challenging and life is hard, but let's just accept that this is the circumstance I'm in and try to find a solution and also be gentle and kind to myself along the way. That would help a lot of people. Mm. They would just be kind to themselves, and life doesn't have to, you know, you don't have to make everything difficult. You don't have to do 10 things to start on a health journey. Just do one nice thing for yourself that makes your life a little easier. Just do something nice for yourself. That's my main health advice on a daily basis. Just be nice to yourself.
I wish you could see, there's this one town in Wisconsin where you drive through and all the shop windows have the words "be kind." It's just like this mantra that you, as you drive through, and now as you talk about kindness, it makes me want you to be able to see that. Tara Parker Pope, well-being editor of the Washington Post, with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Your questions on well-being, lifestyle. You know, Tara, you've written about the importance of having a go bag. Can you explain what is a go bag?
You know, that's funny because I wrote recently about the go bag because it's one of my favorite topics. And a friend of mine wrote me a note and said, "Do you really do all this stuff?" And I said, "Yes, I really do." Because I used to live on a river that flooded a lot and I had to evacuate often. Mm-hmm. I lived, sadly, through 9/11. My building was attached to the World Trade Center. And that was a very, I used to work for the Wall Street Journal. And you know, I experienced, you know, that kind of disaster situation. Fortunately, I was not in the Trade Center, but I was right there. And so I've been through enough of these experiences. I had a neighbor once left their water running upstairs and I came home and they had literally, it was like a swimming pool had dumped into my house and I lost everything. So I have been through some of these things and I have just learned the importance of keeping your documents, your really important documents in one place. So, you know, your passport, your your, you know, just anything that you can't replace quickly, your social security card, your birth certificate, put that stuff in one place and just have a bag ready. You know, think of all these people that are living in fires, and fires can shift in seconds, and you have to just leave the house, grab that, have a go bag ready. I had this situation in January. My father and my stepmother both had COVID, and it was very serious. Sadly, my stepmother died, and it was a big tragedy in our family, but I needed to get to Texas fast from New York. I literally grabbed my go bag and my dog, and I went to the plane. And I am glad I had all those documents with me. I really needed them. So I think that you should think about what can't be replaced. I put mine in sort of a bag and I keep it in a lockbox, but it's all together. And you know, one really interesting piece of advice I had in reporting this story was a whistle. I now put a whistle in my go bag. Because if you ever are, I know this sounds a little nutty, and I don't want to be like, I'm not one of these apocalyptic kind of people at all. I have a pretty optimistic outlook on life. But enough people have found themselves in situations where they evacuate and they need, maybe they need help. Mm. And a whistle, having a whistle is way better than shouting. So I thought having, just put a whistle in your go bag. I liked that piece of advice, actually. Oh, can I say one other thing?
Yes, yes, we're listening.
You know, the thing that an ER doctor will tell you is the most requested item in the ER is a phone charger. And so put a phone charger in your go bag. Think about if you need to rush out, you know, our phones are our lifeline. Mm-hmm. So put an extra charger in the go bag. Don't just say, I'll grab it, because you'll forget. I was in the ER actually recently, and people around me, I had a phone charger. They were like, oh, wow, you have a phone charger. I was like, sure, power up. So yeah, bring a phone. Always have a phone charger with you.
And don't raid your go bag for the phone charger when you can't find your phone charger at home.
Yeah, no, don't do that. Your go bag is an extra set of things that you have, and you really don't touch it. And I really don't touch it. It's really for when you have to leave the house in a hurry. Now, I would tell you, I also have like supplies in my car and stuff. I have I have one of those little hammers that if you can break the window, because I got very freaked out about flooding and flash floods, mm-hmm. and people get trapped in their cars, and there's this little tiny tool that you can like tap. Car windows are very strong, but there is a way you can tap it and break it if you need to. I know I sound a little nutty. My friends think I sound a little nutty, but I'm like, you're going to call me when things get bad. You're going to come to my house.
We'll need you. Health journalist Tara Parker Pope launched a health and wellness hub at the Washington Post called Well-Being. She's helping us stay healthy and sane as we head into winter months. Join in on food, fitness, mind, body, life, what challenges you encounter. Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with health journalist Tara Parker Pope, well-being editor at The Washington Post. Tara, helping us to stay motivated and grounded and really ready, trying to address feelings of isolation and loneliness, daylight hours waning. Still time to talk about well-being. What's on your mind, your philosophy? 800-642-1234. Tara, let's discuss crowds. One of your articles looks at how to survive a crowd surge, like what happened in Seoul during Halloween. What can people do in that situation?
Oh, this was just such an awful situation. Mm. And I, you know, I approached this knowing that ultimately the responsibility for taking care of large crowds lies with our public officials, and we need to hold them accountable when things go wrong. But I think, you know, as individuals, you can't always count on the, you know, people around you to make good decisions, right? On, you know, on your public officials to make good decisions. So as I was watching the story unfold, I thought, oh, what can people do to stay safe? And what would I do if I was in that situation? And I spoke with a bunch of experts, and it was really fascinating to learn. I mean, the way people die in crowds is they can't breathe. They get crushed. Their chest gets crushed and their lungs literally can't expand, and they can't get air. And that can happen in about 6 minutes. Mm. And, you know, the advice was very fascinating, but basically you want to stay on your feet in a crowd. So like, if you're going to be in a crowded situation, if you're going to go to a concert, leave the cute shoes at home and put durable, strong shoes on your feet, because it will help you maintain your balance and support. And if people, a lot of times people step on your feet and that's what makes you fall. So if your feet are somewhat protected, you're going to do better in a crowd. Keeping your arms free. The really horrible, tragic thing that was happening to people is that their arms were literally pinned by their sides and they could not lift them. They could not move. And so if you find yourself in a packed crowd, pull your hands up. The advice is to take your dominant hand and just grab the forearm on the other hand. And it keeps your arms up. It keeps you from getting pinned. It happens very, very fast. So don't think, oh, I'm okay right now. I'll be fine. It happens really fast. You go from being safe to unsafe. Seconds. So keep your arms up. What you do when you do that and when you grab your forearm, you're creating like a little cage almost around your chest, and you're in a position where your elbows can brace against other bodies and give your chest room to breathe. And if you have a backpack, switch the backpack to the front, because you're creating extra space between you and the other bodies, and that could make the difference between surviving the experience and not. A lot of people had their phones up and they were filming, and it's good they did in a way, because we have documented this. But at the same time, if that phone drops, you do not pick it up, because if you're trying to go down and get that phone, you will not get back up.
What about helping others who have fallen?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I thought the thing that was so interesting, a friend of mine said, I had always heard you don't help other people. Every single expert I heard said that the thing about crowds is that working together with the people around you is how you survive it. And if somebody nearby is struggling, and if they trip or if they fall, there's literally this thing called crowd quake and crowd turbulence. And if one person falls, it can make the crowd collapse and people fall on top of each other. And you are at tremendous risk of dying in that situation. If you've got somebody around you that is struggling and you can help them, pull them up, let them hold on to you. If they're small and you're bigger and you're stronger, if you help the people around you, it protects the crowd around you, and you're more likely to get out of it alive if you help the people around you. That was really.
Yeah. Is there a safer place to be if you're going to be in a packed crowd? What area should you be in?
So it sort of depends on what kind of crowd it is. I think in the very sad situation in Seoul, those were long, narrow streets, and there was really no safe place in that group. But imagine a crowded concert where everybody's sort of flocking toward the stage. If you're near a barrier, you can be in a little bit of trouble. That's what happened at Astroworld. So, you're thinking about crowd surge and crowd moves. And what's interesting about crowds is that there's just physics that come to play. A lot of people compare it to the ocean and waves and movements and turbulence. And what happens when you're that close, the forces in another person's body are absorbed by your body and the body next to you. And that's why you see these waves and these swirls and people sort of, the movement that happens in these crowd situations is not your movement. It's all the forces coming together. It's physics happening, and it's very hard to kind of stay on your feet in that situation. So the best place to be in a crowd is on the edge of it, on the outside of it. That wasn't necessarily the case in Seoul, because some people were crushed against barriers. But if I'm with my, if my daughter's going to a concert, I'm going to be like, I know it's cool to be like at the very front, but that's not the safest place to be. And just behind the very front is not the safest place to be, because you've got the forces from the front and the back coming at you. Festival seating, standing room only seating. If I were making decisions about my family and what kind of concert I would go to, I would make sure they had a seat and a ticket for a specific seat. You are much safer in that situation. Crowds are much easier to control when everybody's got an assigned seat. And you can trust that the place is not going to get just, these outdoor concerts, they sell extra tickets and they don't always pay attention to crowd control. So, I think concerts are wonderful, fun experiences, and crowds are fun. I mean, crowds are uplifting, except for COVID. I mean, the COVID situation, worry about crowds, but I don't think we should be afraid of crowds. I think we need to be smart and say, has this situation been, is this a big wide open area? Can I get to the edge of a crowd? If I'm in a crowd, can I move diagonally kind of across the crowd to sort of get to the outside of it, so I'm not in the middle of it? Generally,
look at the options. Yeah, like keep looking. Let's go to Carol in Milwaukee with thoughts on crowds. Carol, go ahead.
Hi, I would like to comment on Mexico City. They have a lot of crowds in the metro system, but one time I was actually, it makes you kind of dizzy because it's up in the mountains, and I had just arrived in a plane, and it was nighttime, and I must have been dizzy, and I started falling backwards in the metro station on this really tall escalator, and here I am free falling backwards with my luggage next to me, and I'm holding on to it, I guess. And I thought, all these people behind me are going to all be crushed. You know, this is just tremendous. But you know what the speaker said about helping each other? They all held me up, the guys behind me, whoever they were. They saved not only my life, but how many other lives, because they held me up and didn't let me free fall backwards, which was what I was doing, right into them.
Oh, Carol, that is such a moving story. Tara, what do you make of that?
Yeah, you know, escalators, crowded escalators are definitely a risk. I've been on one where somebody's shoelace, a little boy, his shoelace got caught. He tripped and fell. The parents sort of panicked and they stopped. And everybody behind, we were all, and some very fast thinking person literally just grabbed this boy and pulled him out of his shoes and pushed the parents out of the way. And I mean, the little guy would have been really injured if this quick thinking bystander. So I think the message is that, you know, we're all safer when we take care of each other, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we learned that during the pandemic, and it's certainly true in crowds.
Safer taking care of each other. We have just a moments left here, Tara. Can you give us just, some final thoughts as we head into the holidays, words of advice that we can live by for wellness?
You know, I would just say that, the holidays can be a stressful time, but that we should just have some perspective and, you know, love the people around us and be grateful that we're here to celebrate with them. A lot of people are celebrating a holiday without somebody they cared about, and it might have been somebody they argued with over the dinner table, but that chair is empty now. So I would just say that, you know, go into the holidays with gratitude and perspective. And be kind to yourself. Like, don't get worked up. It's the holiday. It's supposed to be fun. I mean, who cares about the presents? Who cares about, you know, if it's a perfect dinner? I think just approaching the holidays with gratitude and the fact that we're here and that we got through a really hard few years is enough to celebrate.
Tara, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tara Parker Pope is well-being editor of the Washington Post. She previously was the founding editor of Well, the New York Times' consumer health site, and she was part of the Times team that won the Pulitzer Prize for its coverage of the pandemic. And if you missed any part of the show today, you can visit our program page anytime, find hundreds of morning show programs in our archives, some on well-being. It's at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.